You're still listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Still in studio with me is Nate, and on the line from Michigan is Persephone. We're going to talk now about the Americans with Disabilities Act. This was a law that was passed originally in 1990 and went into effect in July of 1990, well, I guess 24 years ago. And then it was amended, you know, about a decade or so ago, maybe 15 years ago. And it's something that since the very, like, day one, it's kind of been plagued with enforcement problems, provisions not being enforced very well or stringently enough, and people not really complying with it and that sort of thing. It was kind of weakly enforceable to begin with, and then it's just kind of had issues ever since then. However, where it has worked, it's made it a lot easier for a lot of people with various disabilities to participate more fully in, you know, the American society and everything. But we're going to look at some areas where it hasn't been working out so well lately, and this is with regard to enforcement of the Americans with Disabilities Act, or the ADA, at colleges and universities. Persephone, why don't you introduce this story for us?
The ADA, as Bill explained, is meant to protect people with disabilities, but one of the key places that this comes into play is higher education, which seems to be for pretty obvious reasons. You're talking about people that are often living on campus or that are spending a great amount of time in the classroom. Now, there have been two major issues that have come up recently. The first has to do with education technology. So the Boston Globe has an article about how electronic educational materials are not necessarily ADA compliant, and in spite of support on both sides of the legislature for this issue, there's a huge amount of dissent from higher education lobbies. And the reason for this isn't entirely clear, because as the Globe points out, the American Council on Education says that by creating accessibility guidelines, which would be voluntary, that is to say that schools could choose to comply with them or not, it wouldn't be mandatory, the ACE says that this creates an, quote, impossible to meet standard, end quote, which is basically saying that colleges cannot comply with the ADA more generally. So one example of how technology isn't necessarily accessible to everyone, if you have a video, for instance, there are actually quite a number of colleges that will put up videos and they won't have subtitles on them. This is not from the article. This is personal observation. Now, something like that might seem pretty basic, but if there is a deaf person watching the video and they don't have captions, or they have to rely on the completely unreliable and often hilariously misleading YouTube captions, that's obviously going to be a huge problem when you're talking about educational material. So that's just one example of ways in which technology can make certain things more accessible to the population at large, but actually reduce accessibility to individuals with disabilities. Did you have any specific thoughts on that yourself, Bill?
This, if I remember correctly, is kind of would be an extension of some of the original provisions that had, like, the FCC saying that TV networks had to start captioning things. Eventually, that was extended to YouTube, that, you know, the rule was if it appears on YouTube, it doesn't need captions unless it has appeared on somewhere else that does require captions. So if it has aired on television, it has to have captions by a certain deadline, because it has to comply with the same rules, since a lot of people are now watching the stuff online instead of, you know, on their actual TVs. It's a similar situation, I think, with Hulu and similar services like that. They have to have some sort of captioning service if it would have otherwise been covered under the captioning rules. You know, so obviously there's some of these technological developments. It's a similar situation in colleges where it's like, okay, maybe when the ADA was originally passed, these weren't as big of a feature in the sort of educational model that was pretty common, but now it's very common and you need to be able to have the technology that's available and being used and relied upon in the colleges. That needs to be accessible to folks with disabilities, whether it's, you know, that they are hearing impaired or vision impaired or something like that. I was particularly struck by that quote that you pulled out about the voluntary standards being an impossible to meet standard. I mean, this is the thing that we've heard since even before the ADA was actually signed back in 1990. these lightly enforced voluntary mechanisms being just the end of the world for these businesses and these sort of powerful interests saying, oh, we couldn't possibly comply with these. It's just too much.
Bill, it's just so onerous to build a ramp. Like, it's just so difficult. Simple machines, they're so complex. I don't know how anyone...
Who can understand a screw? I can't.
What's a lever?
An inclined plane? Get out of here. But yeah, so it's just like... It's just so much complaining, and it's like in the amount of effort that you put into complaining these things and fighting them in court, you could just do the thing that you're supposed to do or that you've been asked to do voluntarily. Just do it and stop complaining about it. It's not these people's fault that they're disabled or that they have some kind of disability, and it's not the sum total of who they are, but it's something that affects their life, and they need to be able to access these services and things like that to the maximum extent possible, because that shouldn't be a limiting factor unnecessarily.
Yeah, so another issue is also that sometimes the attempts at accommodation are completely token. There was a listicle circulating that one of my friends posted on Facebook that was something like 10 ramps you would never want to go down or something to that effect. And it just showed these ramps that were supposedly ADA compliant that were just incredibly steep. So if you had a wheelchair or even a power chair that, you know, had a motor, like, and you went off the edge of one of those, you would just be going straight down at probably a speed you would not be comfortable with. So sometimes these efforts, you know, I mean, sometimes they really don't even try.
Yeah, it's certainly unfortunate that they'll just kind of put in the minimal amount of work after fighting it for years. I mean, I think this is a little bit off topic, but we've seen recently and you've probably been following this as well, Persephone, since you had worked on the Walsh campaign, but Mayor Walsh in Boston had been fighting with the Beacon Hill residents who didn't want to put accessibility measures on Beacon Hill on the sidewalks. So let's talk now about sort of the college sports scene and how that has interfaced with the Americans with Disabilities Act.
Just colleges in general.
Colleges in general.
Instances here. I guess I'll just describe the Kent State case. There was a young woman, a student at Kent State, who was she had severe anxiety problems, anxiety attacks, and a university psychologist recommended to her that she go get a dog, because for a lot of people that suffer from anxiety, having a dog actually relieves a lot of that anxiety. Just having being able to pet or play with them, or having some sort of companion, that helps them a lot. But the university did not approve this dog, didn't really tell her about that, had a discussion between themselves saying that they might approve a cat, but they didn't tell her that either. So they're sort of just waffling around and not really communicating to the student. And then, so then they try to kick her out. And then the Department of Housing and Urban Development, and I think the Department of Justice, are now looking into this for allegedly violating housing discrimination laws, you know, and you know, everything. This goes into the Fair Housing Act and all sorts of other, you know, things that specify protections for people with disabilities. I guess people were complaining that the dog was barking and it wasn't a trained service dog. And so that basically has led to this sort of controversy. But at least luckily we do know that the dog has improved her overall level of anxiety and reduced panic attack. So I guess, you know, that's some part of good to come out of this. But Persephone, what are your thoughts on just this whole situation?
Well, yeah, it also comes, you know, there's historically been a lot of issues with whether dogs should be registered as service dogs, therapy dogs in particular. And so obviously that's a tricky issue. Go into that a little more later. But I think that in this case, if it was clearly helping the student with stress and with anxiety, and if the U.S. Justice Department sees it as an ADA issue, then clearly this dog was necessary. I mean, I don't think they would get involved if it were just a case of, oh, like, they aren't letting me have my puppy, you know, that I got for my birthday, yeah, like, on campus. This seems to be a pretty serious violation on behalf of the university. It seems like she really needed it. That said, you know, there have been some issues with people just putting a harness on a dog and saying, this is a service dog. And actually, there are a few companies circulating the internet that sell service dog harnesses that people can buy. That is not, once again, I don't think this is what was going on here, but I think it is important to note that there are violations. And I mean, a certain amount of confusion on behalf of the institution might be understandable, but kicking this woman out or telling this woman she can't have this dog, which is there for a medical reason, is clearly completely unacceptable.
Yeah, Persephone, when I first read this article, I was, you know, just a little confused or somewhat skeptical, just because, you know, you don't really hear too many cases of people with non-service dogs because of various anxiety issues. But when you read that, it was recommended to her by a university psychologist, and she's clearly dealing with some severe anxiety issues. You know, you just wonder, is this really where we should be, you know, having like a real stickler, oh, it's not a service dog, or oh, you don't have a quote unquote like disability, like being blind or something like that, where, you know, it would be a little less ambiguous where you'd have a service dog. I mean, if someone's breaking out into panic attacks and the dog actually helps, and there's the fact that the psychologist actually prescribed that or recommended getting that, you know, and in, maybe instead of or in addition to psychotropic drugs, you know, I think that would be a good thing. And probably, I mean, barking or whatever, you don't want people having psychotic attacks in your apartment. So, I mean, I think it probably would work out the best for everyone. But obviously, some people just get a little too annoyed by dog barking. And then we've got to drag the Justice Department into it.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those situations where maybe at first glance it looks like one thing, but then you realize that it's actually, you know, pretty warranted. And it's not like she was just sneaking a dog into her apartment or something. I mean, has that happened? Like, you know, you hear about that happening when, you know, in the dorms in college about, oh, somebody's tried to sneak in a cat or whatever, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, well, that's not this situation. This was something that was, you know, from a medical standpoint, was advised and seemed to be helping her. And, you know, maybe it's barking and needed to be, you know, needed a little bit more training or something, but it's like the net positive was clearly there. And also, I think that, you know, this is one of those examples, like with Persephone saying, you know, maybe there are some people that are abusing things like, you know, putting dog harnesses on non-service dogs and whatever, and that's not appropriate. But on the other hand, there are situations where somebody might have some disability that's less visible or that you don't know about or whatever, if you don't, you know, if you're not really familiar with them or something, or even if you are, they might not tell you. And so you do have to kind of balance that of like, don't assume that people are doing it maliciously. If they are, that's, you know, not appropriate and is hurting people who do have disabilities. But it's also not the job of every person to be going around policing who has a quote unquote real disability versus not.
Yes. And I think that the issue of the barking, I think that there should definitely, I mean, I think that trained service dog, there's an important reason that, that people get actual trained service dogs, and that is to avoid those issues. So I think that that's, an important thing to consider. But I'm looking right now at the ADA.gov's commonly asked questions about service dogs. They say, if you're not certain that an animal is a service animal, you may ask the person who has the animal if it is a service animal required because of disability. However, an individual who is going to a restaurant or theater is not likely to be carrying documentation of his or her medical condition or disability. Therefore, such documentation generally may not be required as a condition for providing service to an individual accompanied by a service animal. There are certainly situations in which you cannot ask for proof of disability. So I think that's an important nuance to add to this.
Can we talk about the parking situation?
Yeah, so this was another instance of a university where they're just not providing necessarily the most accessible opportunities for people in wheelchairs. So there's an example of this woman, Catherine Getz, who's about 80 years old, and she's been going to Penn State football games for 50 years, and now she needs a cane, and now I think she, although I think it mentions later that she got an electric wheelchair. Basically, they changed the disability parking areas. So instead of being close to the stadium, it's now about 2 miles away. you know, and you have to take a shuttle down, down the interstate, down the Park Avenue to get to the stadium, often where the thickest game day traffic, as says in the article here. So basically, instead of being able to tailgate with her friends and family, now Getz has to get on the bus, and, you know, on the bus are a bunch of other people in wheelchairs. I think I actually said there were supposed to be 20 buses, but there were only five were running, and they could only fit three wheelchair-bound passengers at a time. Wheelchairs are falling over each other, and
yeah, somebody, you know, actually
elderly
tipped
lady
over.
Got a bump on her head, and it's just not safe. And so on the return trip, she didn't take the bus again. She just thought it'd be too much of a risk. So
they just motored back.
Yeah, the alumni that were quoted basically saying they took the electric scooter back because they didn't really want to go on the bus. Just didn't seem safe.
I don't really know who puts handicapped spots 2 miles from the stadium.
Isn't the point of handicapped spots is that they're supposed to be close to, you know, wherever you're supposed to go?
Yeah.
And not so much 3 miles away, 2 miles away, wherever. I mean, it just doesn't seem well thought out at all.
Yeah, clearly a bad decision-making process going on here. It doesn't really make any sense to force people onto buses that are in wheelchairs or that have other disabilities, especially given that the article said that some of the buses were not accessible. I think that in this situation, you know, it's kind of one of those things where it was just really poor planning, where they could have easily foreseen that this would be an issue, and somebody just didn't care or didn't think about it, and you end up in this really poor situation.
Yeah, and there are also quoted examples here of various other parking spots that, you know, could be potentially used, but it's basically impossible for them to be used. So there's like a softball park, and you have to pay thousands of dollars to get into the Nittany Lions Club to be able to use those parking spots. And there's some there's about 50 spots nearby the stadium, but apparently there's like all sorts of pedestrian traffic and there are no handicapped accessible restroom facilities in the area. And you have to basically get there super early, and then you have to wait to get out until the pedestrian traffic has dispersed. So there are just no current workable solutions. So, I mean, it's not well thought out at all. 2 miles away and getting five buses to shuttle people around just seems one of many issues at Penn State currently.
Yeah. And I think that all these discussions sort of bring us back to the question of, you know, enforcing the ADA. In one of these cases, we have the Justice Department directly intervening. But I think it's important for people who do not have disabilities to think about just how much we take for granted. Because for somebody who has to deal with, you know, a place that doesn't have curb cuts, a place that has parking spaces far, far away from where they're trying to get to, all these little things really build up and make life a whole lot more difficult for something, you know, for someone who already is restricted in mobility more generally. So I think the ADA is a really important law, and I really think there should be more ways to enforce it. It seems kind of, you know, ridiculous to have to invoke this, you know, federal procedure every time. I mean, I think, you know, if every single thing that's not accessible, you can't use the ADA to address every single thing that's not accessible because there are just too many things that aren't accessible. There are just too many violations out there. And there needs to be a clearer, maybe more local process that would enable people to deal with these issues.
Yeah, just a couple things I just wanted to add. A good friend of mine who's, you know, pretty on the libertarian side of politics, he also had a friend who fell out of a tree and became paralyzed and, you know, subsequently was in a wheelchair. And, you know, he sort of, I don't know where he exactly was to begin with, but he sort of did like a big reversal and is super supportive of the ADA and, you know, how they should basically force businesses to comply in order to, you know, just provide more access, because, you know, obviously he sees firsthand that being in a wheelchair actually makes you have a lot of limitations. And if there aren't people that are, you know, going out of their way to comply and make sure that, you know, everywhere is accessible, it kind of makes things just way more difficult than they need to be for someone in a wheelchair. And so just, you know, after experiencing that firsthand, someone who's, you know, not particularly enthused about getting the government involved in private enterprise is actually pretty supportive of that, because he knows it's for, you know, it's for the common good, and it's important for people that suffer from physical disabilities. So, you know, just that's an example of people's minds being changed by actually interfacing with the issue. So just a thing I have to throw out there.
All right. Well, that's going to bring us to the close of this segment. Nate, thanks for being in studio with me.
Thanks, Bill.
And Persephone's going to stay on the line for another quick segment just after this break. Arsenal for Democracy will be right back after this. You're still listening to Arsenal for Democracy. It's our 100th episode, and so we wanted to take a moment to note that. Persephone is still on the line with me from Michigan. She's been doing a lot of the shows since earlier this summer, and of course she did quite a number of shows in 2013 as well. We started this back in fall 2011, and we've had a lot of folks on the team in different elements and different roles. I've sort of obviously been here for every episode. You know, we were recording first in Newark, Delaware, and then we're still broadcasting there, but now recording from Newton, Massachusetts, and bringing in people from all over the country and all over the world to help participate in that. I think a lot of people know that sort of the original reason for developing the show, besides the fact that I have a lot of opinions on the news and like to talk about them, is that I really wanted something that was focused on looking at these issues from a younger perspective and also talking about how they relate to younger people. And sometimes some of these issues don't necessarily relate to younger people specifically, but it's still nice to have that venue for talking about them in that context. And I think that we've really covered a large range of issues and talked to a lot of people, both as, you know, co-hosts and guests and various other contributors, full-time or part-time contributors. There's definitely been a lot of people working on this effort with me, and I certainly could not have done it without them. So it's definitely been a team effort, and a lot of times we have a lot of discussions off the air as well that don't even make it onto the air, where we kind of sound out various ideas and things like that. We actually have a couple calls from listeners who have also been contributors or guests at one point or another. So I was going to play those calls. So the first call is from Rachel in Idaho, and she guest co-hosted with me once, and she wanted to call in to talk about our 100th episode of Arsenal for Democracy.
Hi, this is Rachel, one-time contributor to the Arsenal for Democracy. Congrats on making 100 episodes, and here's to 100 more episodes of Bill's rants and other awesome progressive media content. Thanks. Bye.
Well, thank you so much, Rachel, and thank you so much for coming on the show in the past.
And we've got our second call here, a few highlights from that. This is from Ama, who is in the St. Louis area. You might remember he was on our one of our Ferguson-related episodes several weeks ago, talking about things that he had seen firsthand there. So let's give a listen to what he had to say.
Hi, this is Ama Aningo from St. Louis, and I've been listening to Arsenal for Democracy probably since this show's been airing. Haven't listened to all 100 shows, but I've probably listened to at least half. And the reasons I love the show include, first and foremost, the attention to the global stage that the show exhibits. There's a lot of coverage of lesser-known parts of the world and countries and conflicts, and less navel-gazing, as we tend to do here in the United States. I also like the interplay between host and co-host. There have been different hosts with different experiences and different perspectives that enriches the show. So that's a second benefit. And a third is just kind of the general informative tone of the show. It's not a bully pulpit for a personality. It's not one of these personality-driven shows, even though Bill is quite the personality. It's more about facts and data and backing it up, and appreciate that. Congrats on the 100th episode, Arsenal for Democracy. I'll definitely keep listening. Salute.
I really think that these guest contributors really make the show what it is. I mean, we don't have guest speakers in many of our episodes, but every time we do, it brings a whole nother perspective.
Right. I definitely agree. I mean, some of those, they can be a little bit challenging. Sometimes they're certainly logistically tricky to you know, get organized. I mean, at that Ferguson one where we had three different folks on in addition to me at one time, you know, it can be a challenge, but it's really rewarding in the end because we get to hear a lot of things that we don't get to hear in general from various media outlets, I think. That's why I think it's so important. And they're also just, they're interesting people that I want to talk to. So we've done various interviews on the show, you know, on a whole range of topics. We interviewed a U.S. Senator, even Tom Carper from Delaware. And we've done expert or guest interviews or eyewitness interviews on a whole range of topics. Some of them included the mechanics of Mitt Romney's private equity takeovers, filibuster reform, Venezuelan politics, the history of vaccine science, the Ebola outbreak, European Union elections, Nigerian history, the Ferguson protests, risk to humanitarian aid workers, UN diplomacy on chemical weapons in Syria. And for those, a lot of those, I mean, those people in general have been there. You know, they're either there right now when it's happening, or they've seen it, you know, firsthand previously, or it's something that they've, you know, become an expert on over time in a lot of those cases. And it's been a real honor to have a lot of these folks on, and they don't necessarily always get platforms in other venues. So it's really great to give them the opportunity to bring their perspective to the table, which I think is a point that Amma summed up pretty well. And we've also discussed a lot of really creative big ideas for major reforms in the U.S. And I think that's been a sort of more recent element, but that's been really fun. Early on, we covered a lot of the stuff in the 2012 Republican presidential primaries. Obviously, that's a little bit more fluffy and maybe not as substantive. But I mean, we got a lot of jokes about Herman Cain's 999 plan out of that. So that was some good mileage. And, you know, we covered elections all over the world, so kind of balanced out the stuff that everyone is covering in the U.S. with stuff that almost no media outlets are covering most of the time. And we looked at issues in countries that don't get much attention in general. You know, I think that's a point that our past co-host Greg has made, you know, and other folks too, that, and I think Amma mentioned this as well. You know, I'm very passionate about talking about, you know, what's going on in South Sudan or what's going on in the Central African Republic. And when we can't fit them on the actual radio show, I usually have stuff going up on the blog on arsenalfordemocracy.com, which has been another sort of side effect of doing this show that's been really important, I think. And we've also put light onto both positive and negative, you know, proposals and legislative ideas and stuff that we've seen in the U.S. that haven't been getting enough attention, whether they should be getting more attention because they're good ideas or they should be getting more attention because they're terrible ideas. We've talked a lot about those. Persephone, what were your thoughts on some of these things and maybe things that I didn't mention?
I think that we've done a lot of really interesting stuff. I personally think that there's something unique about Arsenal for Democracy in the breadth of the material we cover. And I think that one great thing is that each of us has a different area of knowledge. You know, Greg and Nate are always down to do sort of the politics of the athletic world, and they are just like basically experts on that, you know. And then, you know, I tend to have specific knowledge on like Spain. And I think just having so many different people with so many different focuses has just been a huge asset to the show. I can also mention some of the people who haven't contributed recently, but who also have their particular areas of expertise. Sasha, for instance. And I just think that this show has been a great way to bring all these people together. Because even if I haven't been on a show with every single person who has contributed or every single person who has co-hosted, I still feel a sort of sense of connection through listening to the show, through having contributed myself, and through seeing all these comments about the show. I think it really has built a network.
I certainly hope so. I mean, that's kind of the goal. All of it, at the end of the day, pretty much everything is definitely, this is something that I'm personally interested in talking about or looking at. I like to think that, you know, you're going to hear a segment on this show or read about it on Arsenal for Democracy 2 weeks or 6 months before it becomes huge news, you know, in the rest of the media. I think that that's been happening quite a bit more and more in the past year or so, which has been a pretty dramatic year. I mean, I think I opened kind of Arsenal for Democracy for 2014 with coverage of what eventually became ISIS. I didn't even know that was going to become as big of a thing as it became. But, you know, that was something that I was putting a spotlight on, and it was getting a little bit of attention, but I was kind of looking at it sort of in a wider context rather than looking at it in a vacuum. And that's kind of the thing that I especially try to bring to it, is sort of that historical long-term context of how did we get here? Where is this from? I like to think, or I hope, that I'm bringing stuff to people's attention before it's being brought up in other places, because I see that it's going to become important, or that it should become important, and isn't getting enough, you know, love from the media as a whole. So,
Arsenal for Democracy. We analyzed it before it was cool.
I'm glad that we've made it to 100 episodes, and you know, we're gonna keep going full steam ahead on this. And you know, thank you, of course, to the folks at WVUD in Newark for kind of helping me get this launched and continuing to support me in this. But anyway, thank you so much, Persephone, also for sticking around to talk about some of the highlights of the past 100 episodes with me. And we hope to have you back on the show quite soon.
Of course.
All right, well, that's going to bring us to the end of the 100th episode of Arsenal for Democracy. Thanks for listening to Arsenal for Democracy. Tweet us your comments at AFDRadio or email AFDRadio@gmail.com. The show is available for download from ArsenalForDemocracy.com on Wednesdays. You can also hear it on the air in Delaware from 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark every Wednesday night at 6 p.m. Eastern. Special thanks to my voiceover man, Justin. You can follow his work at the Digitized Ramblings of an 8-Bit Animal from 8BitAnimal.com. You can get additional commentary at ArsenalForDemocracy.com daily, as well as links to articles discussed today. From my studio in Newton, Massachusetts, I'm Bill Humphrey, and I approve this message. Good night.